That is a new clip by Bruce Rainier. Thank you, Bruce. And Ray Stanford, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Ready to go.
Great. You may want to get a little closer to the phone.
Okay.
And thanks so much for joining us. You know, you were on back in July, and thank you so much for being a graceful person and offering to be on the show live when I couldn't make it down there last week. I really appreciate that.
My pleasure.
And we're going to be talking about all kinds of things. Why don't we go over quickly? We don't want to baffle the people listening, but we'll go over quickly what we're going to cover in the first hour, and then possibly in the second hour, time permitting. So why don't you just throw us kind of a an overall what we're going to talk about tonight?
Okay. Actually, I decided that it might be good to give people the discovery background that I come from. That is to say, since the early 1970s, I have been heavily involved with the use of optical and electronic instruments, cameras, movie cameras, dual cameras, spectrographic cameras, recording ELF magnetometer, recording gravimeter, and other fancy equipment to try to get something that can really, let's say, be chewed on by the scientific community, that we don't have to take on faith or as hearsay, or speculate about something that is diagnostic. And so I wanted tonight to list and briefly describe at least nine of the specific UFO-related phenomena that we have documented again and again in daylight. And we, my group, my project has always focused, except for in one event, on daylight events, because the films you get are much more interesting and informative than when you're dealing with just bright lights against a black sky. So the first thing that we discovered that really, it wasn't the first thing, but it was the first thing that really set us back. It just absolutely surprised us. That was not anticipated by anything we saw in the literature, is what we call the multi-image phenomenon that occurs around the objects that we're filming, in this case, in broad daylight. Now, let me mention that this particular phenomenon, when you see it on film, you want to film it as fast as you can, as many frames per second as you can, and at a higher, as high as you can. But this is something that if you look at the object in the broad daylight sky, you will not see this phenomenon. Instead, what you will see is actually you look at the object passing across the sky, as a group of hundreds of Boy Scouts did in the 1950s on Catalina Island, and you will see a darker blue around the object than the sky, and it doesn't look like a corona. That's because the individual images of the object that are there in what we call multi-imaging are sequencing at high speed, and your brain, eye and perceptual system are flicker fusing them into a single image that may seem to slightly vibrate, but will not be segregated into distinct shapes. But when you see them on film, you'll see that these images that pop into view, apparently sequentially and at high speed, are extremely fast. And but you can, well, I'll give you an example. My best filmed example of this was made on February 16th, 1986, when my wife and I were heading into Andrews Air Force Base, just outside the east side of the Washington, D.C., by the way, to have dinner with an Air Force colonel friend of ours and his wife and kids. And we saw something quite incredible. We saw two things that the literature would call from 1950s. They might call it a great cloud cigar, but others might call it a mothership. Whatever happened, one of them, when we stopped and got the camera ready to film, very quickly phantomed out like a rheostat turning down a light, but the other remained, and it had objects going to and from it. Well, this was at a time of day when the light, fortunately, of this backlighting of the sky was highly polarized because the sun had just set, and the light in that direction was highly polarized. This is the ideal time to visually segregate these images on your film. It's much more distinct when you're filming in polarized light. And what happened is we got the best film of this that I have ever gotten. I'm thinking, for example, of a frame that I have here on my computer right now, that when you get to counting the images that are visible, well, I lost track at 400, around 400. They are images of the object itself, but they're all around it, and you get the impression, the way they overlay of each other, that they are sequential, but they are not. They are like the object, but instead of being positive images, they are negative images. That is to say, where it was dark, it will be light, and where it was light, it will be dark. And yet you can see the object not only in almost any position, if you look in at the proper ones that are in spherical patterns around it, but you can also see them much larger than the object itself. And if you just increase the contrast a little bit in looking at this on the computer, I mean, you can make out details in these so-called secondary multi-images that are only vaguely visible in what we call the target object. So this phenomenon is difficult to understand what's causing it. It's certainly not stealth, because it doesn't keep one from seeing the target object at all. It's something else entirely. And I would, if I had to guess, and it would be only a guess, I would suggest that it may have something to do that could suggest to us that the object might simultaneously have what physics would call local properties, our normal universe as we view it, of gross world objects, and simultaneously with that, non-local properties are things that are normally properties that are present in subatomic particles. And I won't go into the other evidence we have that might confirm this, but because at this point it's speculation, but I would bet that in the future, after I'm long gone and people are studying this beyond what I have, that there's going to be a discovery that is regarded as very basic to quantum physics, because we're going to, I believe, determine that these objects can simultaneously, or at least in pulses, ultimately be local and non-local. Now, that is a remarkable phenomenon. We have it in thousands and thousands of movie frames and still shots that we've gotten, and all in daylight. A very important one that I might mention is what we call pulsed refraction. This is another one that thrills the physicists who have seen the evidence. For example, on December 4th, 1980, my wife and daughter and I were flying back from Mexico City on a flight to San Antonio, Texas. We were climbing through 12,000 feet. We had passed through a layer of cloud below and would be passing through another one above us, but it's open in between. And we observed and filmed out there what the literature would call a mothership, because it had small objects going to and from it. But I won't go into that detail for a moment, but let me tell the thing that relates to pulsed refraction. The object is out there at a distance. You can tell as I'm filming it. Near clouds, you see them pass by the airliner fast due to our motion to the north. And the more distant clouds and the clouds on the horizon, you see pass very slowly. Likewise, the big mothership and the objects near it. So we have what's called parallax of motion. It clearly shows these are large-sized objects a great distance from the camera. But out there on the horizon, there are mountains sticking out of through the clouds from below, mountaintops. And what is really shocking, what really thrilled me when I saw it, was that on the film, well, let me say, I was filming most of the time at 54 frames per second. It's a movie camera, well, on film. This is not digital. It's real old-fashioned emulsion film. And at 54 frames a second, you see the mountaintop, and in four frames, let's see, it dropped out three or four frames, I forget which, I think four frames, you actually see the mountain optically, the top of the mountain optically flattened out. The mountain's not flattening, but the optical image of the light that's coming from behind is being warped in a way that the image becomes shortened vertically. And this happens for five frames, I believe. I'll take that back. Five frames. And then in 15 frames, three times as many frames, it optically grows back up to its normal height. Now, this doesn't occur once or twice. This occurs throughout the film, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of frames. Not only that, and that's right under, that's the mountain that is right under the position in the sky of the so-called mothership with the smaller objects. Now, off to the left, near the edge of the frame, you'll see mountains sticking out of the clouds also. While the mountains below the mothership rise in the few frames that I mentioned, when they collapse optically, the ones over there rise up instead. And when the ones underneath the mothership rise up, they collapse on the left side, the mountains on the left side. So this indicates that we have what appears to be a spheric field of refraction in which there's a differential in the two positions. It's wonderful. It's absolute a wonderful thing for physicists, optical physicists, to handle, because it's things that they can easily handle, and they can calculate the speed of how many arc minutes per second the refraction is reducing the size of the mountain, so forth. In fact, we already have this, and I show it in my PowerPoint presentation. We also have another form of this pulsed refraction that is also quite startling. This was recorded way back in my second color motion picture film that I ever got of a UFO. And in this case, it was on July 28, 1959. And there were nine witnesses in my parents' front yard, and we're out there, and we observed and filmed with two cameras simultaneously, an 8 and a 16-millimeter camera, what the literature would call great cloud cigar motherships. There were four of these that appeared, and they had often objects going to and from them. We got that. But remarkably, after a while, a jet at high altitude came, apparently ordered to do a reconnaissance run on this high-altitude mothership. It's all on film, and you see the contrail of the jet, the vapor trail, go toward the object, and then you see that it turns to curve around the object as if it were making a prescribed reconnaissance run, probably had a gun camera or something operating. In any case, what is really shocking is that when the jet gets near the object, all of a sudden, two things happen. The so-called mothership, if you want to call it that, suddenly, instantly changes shape, and it seems to condense itself into a triangular object that another place is dark black instead. But in the process of doing this, you see that this jet vapor trail, the jet that's curving down toward, around the object, I should say, instead of seeing one of them, there are actually five other images of that trail invisible in pulses. So you have apparently, and I would suggest that because of the shutter speed, these may not have been simultaneous images. One may have been at one location, and the next moment in the exposure, they were at another. But the point is, the film recorded pulsed refraction, just like the Mexico film years later. So here we have evidence that has never been talked about in the literature, but the kind of thing that should make it into major scientific physical science journals. There's a lot of other things, but I'll slow down here and see if there's anything you want to ask me before I go on.
Oh, yes. First of all, thank you for all that information. You know, when you were starting to talk about this, the first thing that came to mind in my speculation was, is there any type of interdimensional thing going on here? Is that another thing you thought of, or are you thinking strictly along the lines of this refraction?
Well, I hesitate to bring in interdimensional discussion because, in the first place, we have to have a definition of what one means by that. And the only people that really understand this are the theoretical physicists that are dealing with it with mathematics. And I know a lot of people in metaphysics are taking up this and claiming, oh, yes, these are interdimensional, blah, blah, blah. Well, they may be, but what do they mean by that?
Yeah,
you got to give us a definition, you see. And what I prefer to deal with, Martin, is to look at what is physically there. We can show evidence that there is a glow that's brighter than the sunlight. There's a plasma there, and that there is refraction there. And to deal directly with what we can get a handle on without going into theoretical physics at a level that we do not have adequate data to deal with.
Sure. Now, when I was out in Phoenix, I sat for quite a while and had a really nice discussion. I really enjoyed speaking with Chris O'Brien. He's someone you've known for years, and he's been on the show last April, a year ago. So Chris was telling me that he saw this particular film you were just talking about, and he said it really blew his mind. He said from one frame, this object was in one place, and the next frame in the film, unaltered film, it was in a totally different spot, you know, instantly, which is at 54 frames a second is really an amazing feat.
Yes. Well, this was the film that was taken as we were climbing through 12,000 feet north of Mexico City. The pilot told me that at the time, the beginning of this event, that we were flying over the Tizayuca omnidirectional radio beacon north of Mexico City. So we have an exact place where about the time I started filming what was visible off the left window of the plane. Let me mention that there is another very, very important phenomenon that was recorded in that amazing film. And I have recorded this very nicely in two different films, but that was the best one. What happened is, there's one frame. This was published in November of 2013 at a major physical science conference in Moscow, presented by a major world-class theoretical physicist. And but what happened is, at that point, at the what would be the north end of this large mothership that was out there, there were other objects. But there was a disc-shaped object out at the right end, the north end of this mothership. And all of a sudden, in a single frame, it's gone. But you see it there, but the next frame, it's not there. And when it in that frame where it starts to go, you see a beautiful array of 20-some-odd concentric light and dark rings. Now, these are not rings that are just perfect circles in the photo plane. Those could easily explained as artifacts. No, these are exactly in parallel with the tilt out of the photoplane of the body, the disc-shaped body of the object itself. You can see that the light and dark ovals or ellipses are parallel to the actual plane, as though they are from an effect that is radial to the symmetric plane of the object. It is just beautiful. It tilts substantially out of the out of the vertical and downward to the left side of it, downward exactly like the disc. It's just, a physicist would say it's mouthwatering. This is stuff they can eat with their minds, and several of them have and been really thrilled. In fact, that's why that particular physicist, when he saw this, when I showed it at a secret conference we had in Bavaria in Germany a few years back, he asked me, please promise me, can I use this in a scientific paper? And I said, yes, indeed. And this was well received by the group, the scientist. This is an international conference. It was in Moscow in November of 2013, but there were scientists from all over the world. And most of these talks are so specialized that you'll have only a few people can even understand them, and so a few people that show up. But because of the subject, he announced that his subject was evidence of strong magnetic fields in these objects. Not only were all the seats filled, They were standing around the walls and out the door. And he had received an email from the head of the Soviet Academy of Sciences that said, I wish I could make it, but I can't. My wife and I are on vacation the week you're going to do this. Well, however, he decided he better come anyway, and he came and walked in and was just thrilled. And the scientist that produced this, that showed this, said that there was no negative reaction at all, that people were genuinely interested and asked excellent questions, and there was no one throwing mud or saying this is absurd. Well, he showed not only an enlarged print of the Faraday rings from the film, but he also showed several analog graphs that we have made of these objects when we recorded their extreme low-frequency magnetic field and also showed what's called a Fourier analysis that analyzes the frequencies and magnitude of the signals. So this is the kind of thing you see that you're not talking ghosts and goblins. You're talking about things that physicists can understand and get their teeth into. But anyway, that was all the same film from Mexico.
Wow. Ray, I want to talk a little bit more about scientists in just a minute. But you mentioned just a minute ago that you spoke with the pilot to get the bearings of where this was filmed. Did the pilot himself actually see the object?
I do not know. What I understand that pilots are very hesitant to talk. Now, in one major event, 12-12-77, the pilot not only contacted me, as did a stewardess from the airline, but he literally brought his wife to Austin to see the movie and the enlargement from it and confessed to me that not only had he seen it, but that it was so awesome that he violated the rules and turned the airliner about 10 degrees off J-42 because he was a little apprehensive of this brilliant, incredible object. And in this case, though, what I did, I simply sent a note up via the stewardess to the pilot, and I asked him, I said, can you tell me where we were located, the above-ground location, and I gave him the time. And, of course, he had to know that something was odd that I would even ask this, but he simply sent a note back and told me, at that moment, we were flying over the Tizayuca omnidirectional radio beacon. So I don't know in that case whether the pilot actually saw it, as in the other case happened.
Uh-huh. Ray, I don't want to get too far off track, but just to tell the listening audience, you're a very renowned dinosaur tracker, and you are near Goddard Space Center. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because you actually know a number of people there. Has any one of these scientists actually seen any of this, the film evidence that you have?
Oh, sure. In fact, for example, there's a major scientist that, for example, this scientist, you can truly call him a rocket scientist. He designed, I think there's 7 or 11, maybe or 7, 8 or 8 actual cesium ion engines used in maneuvering spacecraft out in deep space. And he has, I believe, 7 instruments in which he participated in the major design on the recently orbited MAVEN orbiter around Mars, studying the upper atmosphere. And he has seen them and been extremely enthusiastic and encouraging me about this. And also there's a major, a chief scientist at Goddard that has also seen this, most everything that I have, and is very thrilled. And he keeps reminding me, he flies frequently on NASA business, and he keeps reminding me that now every flight he makes, he watches out the window as long as he can and keeps his camera ready.
Now, when you talk to people like this, do you think they actually speak to other people about it, or do you think they kind of just keep it to themselves?
I think it really depends on the individual. Each one is an individual. Some of them are talkative, and others are a little more shy. I've showed this to a lot more people, too. I'm not going to name any of them, but there are a lot of people that are really enthusiastic. In fact, even as I addressed on February 1st, 2013, at Goddard, I was asked to present my dinosaur material to the what's called the NASA Goddard Science Colloquia Lecture Series, and I did. Well, we have reason to believe that I will probably get accepted to present something that might at least half jokingly and half seriously be titled "What the Goddard Dinosaur Tracker Tracks When He's Looking Up Instead of Down." And I say Goddard Dinosaur Tracker simply because I was I discovered dinosaur tracks there that no one knew were there, and then the whole center got very excited. The head scientist of all the scientists there was over here, and he told me that he was virtually brought to poetry about this. He said he kept thinking about how, well, that old notosaur was walking right there with his tracks so visible. Now, back then, the light was just originating, and he had found out which distant star system was the one that was far enough away to have covered that many million, I think it was 87 million years ago. And he said it was such a wonderful thing, and to think that here at the Space Center, where people are thinking, looking up and traveling into space, they're also walking right over dinosaur tracks day by day, as one astrophysicist who also saw a lot of this material. He said to me, he said, you know, 5 days a week for 3.5 years, I had walked within 6 or 7 feet of that big dinosaur track, and I never knew it. And I said, that's because you're one in your work who looks up, not down.
Yeah,
I was kidding him, of course.
And who knows how many tracks the Space Center was built on, actually, too. You never
A lot of them. Unfortunately, of course, when they make the basements of buildings and the parking lots, all this stuff gets destroyed. But I guarantee you, people are being a lot more careful now that that has happened.
Yeah, that's right. Now, the beam ahead, I want to talk a little bit about that, because that, you know, reading Chris Lambright's book, X Descending, and he talks about Mirabeau, and you had this connection with him about this beam ahead and a possible possible propulsion through, it makes a lot of sense. He made sense out of it and actually did some scientific research on it. Can you talk about that as well?
Yes, yes. Now, this this was something that I found that was, apparently, I think there were hundreds of people that must have seen this. There were hundreds out at the park that day when my two eldest kids and I and three adults on the pier saw, and I filmed it. And we also learned from the newspaper that a boy, a little boy, 11 years old, or 12, I think he was 11, in town actually saw and photographed one of the objects as well. But what was happening with the first seven of the eight objects that in a procession came over horizontally and then turned in an almost straight up disappearing with distance, almost straight up going overhead, was that I only had film four of them in my camera. But what happened is they had, counterintuitively, you have a disc-shaped object with a dome on one side, but believe it or not, these objects were flying with their flat, what we would think of as the bottom of the disc, forward in the direction of travel. And that that particular side, I mean, it's a marvelous, you're going to have to see it, Martin, when you come here. But when you see the blue-green emitters off the rim spiraling around it and the incredible pink hexagon that is across the bottom of this thing, and then in the midst of it, there is a tower. You can see physical structure of the tower and even make out some triangular devices attached to it. But in pulses, the tower would fill with plasma, apparently, and then it would project it in a very narrow column out ahead of it, up to about 30 object diameters. And when you see the presentation, yeah, I mean, it's just wonderful because, well, in the first place, even before we had these image enhanced where you can see the most wonderful details of how the plasma is moving in different areas along the beam, even before that, I mean, you plainly see on the raw film, as Chris Lambright said in his wonderful book, you see that something most remarkable is going on, and that apparently what I interpreted even at that time when I first saw the film was that that it's communicating with the air. This is an electrified beam. This is a plasma beam, and it projects out there, electrifies the air in front. It has its own magnetic field because it has the plasma flowing down it outward, so it has its own magnetic field, and as it electrifies the air in front of it, it causes the air to move to the side, and it gets stronger the closer it is to the source, the object itself and the tower in the center of the what we would think of as the bottom of the object, but actually it's the forward side of the object. And you actually can see this happening, that the air is being moved around, and when it gets near the object, you can actually see in what we would call the Schlieren tonalities in the atmosphere, the light and dark patterns of flow due to the plasma and to the different changes in the amount of plasma there. You can see exactly how when it gets in that strong field right at the object, it just grabs it finally and moves it completely around it and closes it back and back. And I want to encourage people to realize that Chris Lambright's book is the first book using this evidence. It shows that for the first time in history, UFO knowledge based on this film has been used to the benefit of humankind, in that I showed this in Austin to Chris, and I showed it to a graduate student there that just got his master's degree and was going up to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute to get his PhD in aerospace engineering. And I said, look, I believe this is what's happening. This is how these objects can travel much faster than the speed of sound without ever having to push a sonic shockwave in front of them that thus makes a sonic boom, and so we don't hear any sonic booms. And he agreed with me. He said, it's exactly what it looks like is happening. Well, he went up to Rensselaer, and I moved up here to Maryland from Texas. And in the early spring of 1987, I got a call from him, and he said, would you mind if I brought my professor in charge of my PhD program here down to see this? We're coming to an advanced propulsion conference at Goddard Space Flight Center. And he said, I'd like for him to see this, and you explain it to him. Well, he was thrilled. They spent more time here than at the Advanced Propulsion Conference. And at least three times he thanked me, and my wife, fortunately, was here the last time he thanked me and said, Ray, I want to thank you because this week you have given your government a quantum leap through the atmosphere and into space. And then he said to me, he said, but there's a problem. He said, you know, I told you I was here because I am designing a magnetohydrodynamic dish-shaped aerodyne to be powered by a beam from the ground for the U.S. Air Force. But he said, what you showed today and this week and explained in detail will enable it to move much more efficiently through the atmosphere. But he said, I have an embarrassing question. He said, well, you're going to design this. It's going to have the plasma whirling around it in response to the magnetic field. But we don't know how to land it because you open those landing gear out into this whirling magnetic field and you get chaos and it could wreck the craft and kill the pilots. I said, well, sure, but let me tell you how they do it. And I showed him a drawing from a case, a multi-witness case in Puerto Rico. And he showed that the landing gear, he showed it landed on the ground. But instead of being on the rim where an aerodynamicist would place it, it was they were opening out of the middle where a plasma physicist, knowing that its magnetodynamic propel would place it, because there it can open in the quiet of the magnetic vent instead of in the swirl of the plasma round and off of the magnetic torus. And so as a result, I got a call 2 days later after they got back up to Rensselaer, and Scott, the graduate student, said, he said, Ray, he said, you should have seen Professor Melbo. He ran up the stairs at 2:30 in the morning, drew the new schema for the landing gear, and sent it immediately, electronically, to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Air Technical Intelligence Center, Dayton, Ohio. And indeed he did. In fact, Maribel followed through, and when a few weeks later he presented this with the new schema for the landing gear at another scientific conference here in D.C., he sent me also a copy, as he had given me the other book before about the craft. He sent me the one showing the drawing of the modified landing gear, because I was the one that told him how to do it based on what I had learned about these objects. So what I wanted to say is, if people want to talk to people to make people believe that this is, but forget the idea of convincing people these are aliens or anything like that. Show them that the study of this object, these kinds of objects, can benefit humankind by advancing our aerospace technology. And if you want to prove that, I suggest you be real generous and spend the only $9 and something. Go to X Descending website, or even on Amazon.com, and you can buy Chris Lambright's book. Hey, man, you've got the kind of ammunition to show that this subject has finally paid off scientifically, because he proves conclusively by documents, very good investigator, that this thing is what gave him the breakthrough, that he did not have an idea of how to do this before, and that this is what how he learned it, right here at my place, seeing excerpts from this film. So I suggest everybody that wants to be able to talk real practical sense about this research, get Chris Lambright's book. It's an electronic book. Study it and learn to talk the language that has a meaning to the external world beyond those that just want to believe in alien visitation.
Yeah, I highly endorse that book as well. You know, Chris is a good friend, but, you know, I read the book before I even talked to Chris, and I was glued to that, you know, both about the Paul Benowitz case and also about the second part of it. Yeah, about your different videos and this in particular is really fascinating how this whole thing came together. And it's, if this is a major breakthrough and, you know, in the future becomes a part of how we power our spacecraft and things like that, you were actually a little piece of that. How does that make you feel?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't understand your question. What was it?
How do you feel about, you may actually become part of a history of space history?
Oh, well, I feel very good about that. The truth is when I was a little kid, I wanted to grow up, and the only way I knew to propel things at that time was rockets. And through high school, I designed and built rather large rockets. These are not these little models you buy in stores. I mean, the largest one that we launched was just just huge. I mean, we had some pretty remarkable four-stage rockets, and I wanted to go into aerospace engineering, but when I had an encounter on Sunday night, October 21, 1956, and the other encounters, too, that convinced me there was something better than rockets, I then said, wait a minute, I can't go into rocket engineering. But then it took all these years until I got that film in 1980 that I was really able to make the contribution through Professor Marabou that I wanted. And let me say this. People say, oh, man, aren't you angry that Marabou hasn't admitted that he got this idea? No, I didn't ask him to do so. I merely wanted to show him. I wanted to give a gift to humankind that would advance our propulsive technique and hopefully get us into space more rapidly and more easily. And I have this naive, perhaps, belief that as we see a greater universe and the Earth from a greater distance, we may become more cognizant of the silliness of localized fighting and try and move ourselves out into a more cosmic position in relationship to life in general. But I want to say, regardless of whether he ever will acknowledge where he got the idea, but Chris proves it, the thing is, it is to his eternal credit as a scientist and a major aerospace scientist that he open-mindedly came here and looked and responded. He even begged a colleague of his in California to come out, and the guy just refused. He said, I wouldn't believe anybody claims he filmed a UFO, but he tried to get him to come. But what I'm saying is, let's not blackball him because he hasn't said this is where it came from. Let's credit him with having the courage and the guts to come here and listen and look.
Right. Yeah, I totally. And how did he first catch wind of this whole thing? I can't recall
okay.
that part.
That was the Scott, the student that came. He had gotten his bachelor's at Rice University in Texas. He got his master's at the University of Texas, Austin. And then he went up to Rensselaer, the best probably school in the world for aerospace studies, and had Professor Marabou as the professor that's over his PhD program there. And so he got to talking to him, and he said, look, in the first place, he learned Professor Marabou was under contract, that he had designed, in fact, already, a saucer-shaped aerodyne, magnetohydynamic aerodyne that electrifies the air, moves it magnetohydynamically, or magnetoplasma dynamically, if you prefer, that's powered from the ground. In fact, in appreciation of what I told Marabou, he gave me, and you can't buy them, I have an inch-thick volume just showing the details of the construction of this this craft, the initial design of it, and so on. And then there's the secondary one that shows the proper placement of the landing gear. And someone asked me the other day said, well, gee, this was 1987, what's been done? Well, the truth of the matter is, as of 2 years ago, I had a link, I have it somewhere, Marabou was out there with a very advanced shielded laboratory, portable laboratory, that costs millions of dollars, and is shielded because it's in a Faraday cage that will protect them from the potential microwave scatter when they launch this microwave-powered object by a beam from the ground. And it's portable so that they need to go to a different location to do the testing of the disc, but they are out there testing them. They've had this system, this unit to be at the launch site for several years now, and I can assure you that they're out there testing and surely flying some of these things around. And just the other day I saw another release on the Internet showing how they now are thinking they will power this not just from the ground, but can power it from space even better, from a satellite with a microwave beam, and it shows the thing flying along with the beam head. On it just exactly as I taught Marabou to do.
Wow, how about that? We only have a few minutes left to the top of the first hour here. So I just want to ask you a question a little bit off topic of what we're talking about. And first of all, if anyone's listening live, you can jump in the chat room at podcastufo.com and actually pose a question if you'd like. So you saw your first sighting back in 1956, and you've had a lot of sightings. And do you credit that to the fact that you're always looking up in the sky? And I heard from Chris Lambright that you always make sure you have a video camera with you as well.
Well, a movie camera is what I used to carry constantly.
Yep.
And my first sighting, I had looked from age 9 to age 15 regularly, day and night, from my parents' flat roof garage in Corpus Christi, Texas. Never saw anything I thought was UFO, so I'm not an over-imaginative person. I didn't see one until the cop from across the street called me out and said, Ray Stanford, you've been watching top that garage for all these years. You better get out here. There's one passing over your house. Me and the neighbors are out here seeing it. And that was on June 10th, 1954, Officer Ritchie, policeman from across the street. And it began right there. But the truth of the matter is, I'm a very observant person, as evidence. Well, if anybody doubts that, come down to Washington, D.C., to the National Museum of Natural History, Smithsonian Institution, and go to the section called Dinosaurs in the Backyard, and you'll see a picture of me along with my little new species of dinosaur that I found that's on display at the Smithsonian. So I'm an observant person, so I'm observant when I'm looking down, and I'm observant when I'm looking up, and I've trained myself to not scare these things away. There is something that a lot of people do when they have sightings that can actually apparently be sensed by these things and can cause them to leave. But that's another story we can get into if you're interested later on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. Ever since I had my sighting, I changed everything. I mean, and I'm always looking up in the sky, whether I'm driving, flying in a plane, doesn't matter. Where it really did change, change what I do. And I think that's possibly why a lot of people do not see anything, is because, you know, they're involved in their daily lives and going about their business and not really observing up in the sky.
Well, yes. And what I want people to realize is more of these things are around in daylight than night. They know they're easily spotted at night. So believe it or not, most of their activity around cities and things is in daylight. Keep an eye, keep a camera ready.
Right. So that's it for the first part of the show, hour two. And that is with Ray talking about Socorro and some other interesting things and about what he's trying to figure out what to do with all this great evidence that he has. So hold on just for a second through this quick music break. I seem to play that clip by accident a lot. It's kind of an unusual clip, and I apologize for that. But anyway, welcome back. We're here speaking with Ray Stanford, longtime researcher. Interesting, very interesting man. And Ray, we're going to be talking about a number of different things in this hour. Hopefully this hour won't go by as quickly as the last one.
Well, I hope so. I'd like to definitely get into some Socorro things, too, because it just happens that 2 days from now on Friday, the 24th of this month, is the 51st anniversary of the absolutely, totally well-documented Socorro Close Encounter of the Third Kind by policeman Lonnie Zamora.
Yeah, we can just hit on that now if you'd like to, and we can go back to some of the other things you were going to talk about, the anomalous excursion, shadow and all plasma, all
right.
That different type of thing. We
right.
can talk, fill that in afterwards. So coming up 51 years ago.
51.
Yeah.
51.
And so 1964, April, I'm sorry, what was the date?
April 24th, Friday, April 24th.
And so how long... Yeah, I know you were the first UFO researcher there, and you wrote that wonderful book. I highly recommend the book, and that book is still available only by you. I mean, I have actually seen prices now. I don't want to scare anyone away, but I've seen prices for your book up to $200 before.
Yes, actually, the hardcover, it's rather beat up, is selling for well over $200, and I saw someone offering the British paperback, mass market paperback, for more $100 than that. I won't even mention it, but anybody created a buy. But what I wanted to say is that if people want this book, they're lucky if they really want this book, because I still have some. It is they were actually the hardback, published in 1976, the actual one that was printed. They're brand new. I have just a couple of boxes of these left. They're perfect. The dust jacket is perfect. No one's ever read them. And if anybody wants them, here's the way they can get them, and the only way that they can get them at this price. Otherwise, go out on the Internet and pay $200 or more for them. The cost of the book, total, I say $50 for the book and $10 for the high-speed shipping priority mail with tracking. And what they need to do is simply go to PayPal, and if they sign up with PayPal, if they don't already have a PayPal account, it makes your money, your credit card, your bank, or whatever you're using, much safer than if you are giving it around to different people. I recommend PayPal for that reason. They simply go there and say they want to pay Ray Stanford at Dinosaur Tracker at Verizon.net. One word, no spaces, no large letters, just Dinosaur Tracker at Verizon.net. And they want to pay him $60 for the book, the Socorro book. And, of course, you have to supply the address to where you want it the snail mailed. But we'll get there fast. Usually it's there 2 to 3 days. But that's all it takes by PayPal is $60, and I will get it to you, and I will send you the moment it's in the mail. As soon as I get home from the post office, I will send you the tracking number so you can keep track of it all the way to your front door.
And I'll throw this burden at you, Ray, as well. If someone wants to have it signed, put your note in PayPal, and Ray will sign it, won't you, Ray?
Thank you. I forgot that. Yes, indeed. I'll be happy to sign it. And I won't say you're a personal friend if you're not, but if you want me to, you know, I'll say best wishes or every good wish or just sign it. Or if you want it signed to a friend, tell me the friend's name, and I'll sign it to that friend.
Yeah. And then once you get in the mail, don't go putting it on the Amazon for $200. Read it first.
No. Keep it. It's a treasure.
Yeah. So anyway, I really, really enjoyed the book, and I read that I don't know, maybe 2 years ago. And I tell you what, I started reading that book, and I couldn't put it down. It was just one of these, you know, I'm really into the subject. But you rewrote such a great account of as if you were, you know, that you felt like you were right there yourself. And you wrote it, 12 years after it came out. But your account was so fresh as if you were right there. And what a great book that is. And so I want to just talk to you about that. So you showed up 2 weeks after this happened. Okay.
Let me correct one thing you said, Martin. I was not the first UFO researcher to show up there. The first UFO researchers to show up there were Jim and Coral Lorenzen of the Aero Phenomena Research Organization, because they heard about this right away. They had the contacts in New Mexico. I didn't hear about it until Sunday, when I had a call from a friend in Texas that told me about it and said, "Why aren't you in Socorro, New Mexico?" And so I took off right as soon as I could to get there. So they were there first, but they made a serious mistake. For example, they got taken in by the story of Captain Richard T. Holder, a Marines commander at White Sands, who told them that Zamora had described a inverted a V with an arc over it and a line underneath it, a vertical V with the arc over it and line, which is not what he saw at all. And I won't go into that again. You can. There are places on the internet where you can find this and define how I've conclusively proven, partially with the help of Captain Holder's son, Richard T. Holder Jr. I've shown that it was a cover-up, that they wanted to make sure that nobody hoaxed this, and if somebody came claiming the wrong symbol of what they were giving out, they would know they didn't have to pay any attention to them, that it was a hoax. And the Air Force took this up because for them, they wanted to try to prove this was a Black Project craft. And if it's a Black Project craft, they certainly didn't want the real insignia that was on it to get out, because somebody could find out who was making it and get some secret information on it. Well, they spent a large amount of money and a whole lot of effort and man hours to see if this was the case, but they proved conclusively it was not anything that was being made here, much to the upset of Captain Hector Quintanilla of Blue Book. So anyway, that's basically what happened. The Lorenzens were there, but they did get taken in. They didn't interview enough people that were right there early on who saw Zamora's original drawing and heard what he originally said was on there to determine that what they were being told was not the truth.
Right. So when you were there, let me just ask you something. I know that you were there for a while and you left, and you did come back. Is that right?
I made numerous trips to Socorro, yes.
Excuse me. And were you, it's like I said, it's been a couple of years since I read the book. Did you actually talk to those other people that were driving in a car and saw this thing?
No. We haven't been able to locate them. They, you know, at the time when they stopped at the gas station and told Opal Grinder and his son, who owned the gas station, Opal did, they told us, they just complained. They said, you know, there's this weird thing almost took the antenna off of our car. It flew right over our car. You got some weird pilots and some weird craft around here. And then we saw a cop head over the direction. It seemed to come down behind the hills, and we saw a cop head that way. I think they thought the cop was going to get into him for coming too low over the highway. But you see, Opal Grinder didn't know that this had happened. Nobody else in Socorro did, except unless they were listening to the police radio. See, they had driven past the south side of town where they saw this to the north side of town where Opal's station was. And Opal said, well, that's interesting. And that was it. He, you know, had he known what had happened, he would have said, wait a minute, can I get your name and, you know, your contact information? But he had no idea. If these people were telling the truth, he said they sounded totally sincere. They had three boys in the back seat and the man and his wife, and they all seemed upset about this thing almost taking their antenna off their old green Cadillac. But there was no way to trace them down. I did publish the pictures of them, the names of two fellows, Paul Carson and Larry Kretzer, that had been towing a boat from somewhere over on Highway 60 west of the site. And when the thing was apparently when it was landing, it was not Zamora was coming up the just after it had landed. He was coming up the hill on the far side of them, the opposite hill from where they were looking, the opposite side. And he was, as he said, he tried it three times, and third time he got up to the top, he was spinning his wheel so fast he was knocking up dust. Now they thought that the landing object was that it was some kind of a weird smoke that it was sending up, but it wasn't. It was dust. The timing was exactly correct. It was dust being knocked up by Zamora as he tried to, in excitement, get up that hill to whatever was happening over there that apparently had come down. So there were those two witnesses, and there were plenty of auditory witnesses. I interviewed two women who were both in their individual homes, and they heard the roar of the landing and then sharply the roar of the takeoff, and they said to themselves something like, well, you know, we've heard a few sounds from over in White Sands, but never that loud. Wonder what that was. But they didn't know either that Lonnie Zamora was seeing this, so they didn't go outside. They just thought, must be something launched at White Sands or something, and that was it. But I have heard that Lonnie Zamora actually knew of a woman who actually, from some distance away, did see the landing, and I think maybe the takeoff, too. I'm not sure of the details of that.
Ray, a few months ago, you and I had a brief conversation, or maybe an email exchange, because there was some new hoopla about some video that supposedly was found about the Socorro case, and a bit controversial. Do you want to talk about that?
Actually, yeah, it's not anything to be concerned about. What it was, when the old TV show Sightings had covered the Socorro case, a woman contacted him and said when she was a little girl, that she that her family had gone there to the site, and she had found a video of it that they had taken when she was a little girl. It shows her in it, and the thing is, if people want to see what the site looks like, yes, there is that video, and I think it's available on the MUFON Virginia website, thanks to Tony Angiola or Ben Moss. It's on that website if they want to see it, but you're not going to learn anything. Look at the picture during my book, and you'll learn a lot more. Basically, it shows people running around the site. I would judge from the amount of people and the changes in the site that it probably was taken the next weekend, a week later after I was there. It had happened on a Friday, probably taken the next weekend after that weekend that immediately followed the Friday. And a lot of people out there, all from work, decided to go out there and see where this thing had landed. But it really is bad focus, and the clearest thing it shows is a little girl in one or two shots. But other than that, you know, you see the creosote bushes, but since the filmer didn't know really what to focus on or what was seen, there is one story there that was told that's simply not true, and I don't attribute it to a hoax. I attribute it to you know, the started imagination of a little girl who heard the story. She told the people at the TV show that they were at a service station, and that the cop who had actually witnessed it came over and said, oh, look, I saw a UFO out here, and I'd be happy to take you over and show you where it happened. Impossible.
What cop would do that anyway?
No Socorro cop would have done it. I think there is a possibility that the little girl is remembering this. One of the most enthusiastic person about this site, practically, there was Undersheriff James Lucky, a wonderful guy that I described in my book as someone right out of a movie, The Old West. just a wonderful guy, and he may still be living, be getting up in years. But he followed this case, and just he was one of the first arrivers right after this thing took off. And so he's turned on. Now, he might have been, if he saw, you know, the family and the kids there, he might have just enthusiastically said, hey, you know, have you guys heard about the landing that the police officer witnessed out here? And the little girl, you know, I think she was about 6 years old, could have been nine at the time, may remember it, that a police officer, but actually he was just an undersheriff. He might have been wearing a gun on his belt. But I don't think that's a hoax. I think it's just flawed memory. So the film is, if you want to see what the family got, you know, a week, 10 days after the event, that's fine, but it really adds nothing scientifically, no new evidence to the case.
Yeah, and then, of course, you know, speaking of hoaxes, there was the false claim about the college kids doing a hoax with some type of screen. It's so bizarre that it doesn't even make sense, or even, I don't even want to waste time on
that's right.
it, actually.
Yeah, now nothing that is claimed is even at all compatible with the facts of the case. So we don't even need to get into that. I would love to debate the guy and slaughter the case that he tries to make, but
right.
he's too chicken to do that. He won't debate me. He just says Ray Stanford's crazy. Well, you know, it's silly. If he wants to see how crazy I am, go down to see my picture in the Smithsonian Museum. but here's the thing regarding the case. There is other photographic evidence that I'm willing to get into to celebrate the 51st anniversary, that when I come out with it, it's absolutely, I mean, it'll show that this not only was not a student hoax, but it will show that this thing was not a product of terrestrial technology.
Yeah. One thing before you get into that, I wanted to ask about the bushes. Now, was it just a couple of bushes that were set on fire, and did you actually see that as well? Did you actually look at them?
Yes, I looked at them. In fact, you know, I brought home some pieces of the tips of the burned creosote bush, locally known as the greasewood bush. And now, let me correct one thing. You'll see in various accounts they say, the cops arrived and they saw the bush burning. That is totally false. Nobody saw the bush burning. They saw steam coming out of it. Creosote is very hard to, you can put a torch to it and take it away. A few minutes, the flame extinguishes, and you just see a bunch of steam. So basically, they saw steam from the heat coming out of the branches and leaves that had been charred. It did disintegrate about half of the creosote bush where the landing exhaust and takeoff exhaust had played. But certainly was not on fire. And there's a whole lot of interesting things. I could talk about that if you want to get into it, about some evidence that I'm looking at in that respect.
It's totally up to you, Ray.
Well, let me say that right now I have in my possession, I have two rocks. One of them I found about 3.5 or 4 inches below, right where the landing and takeoff exhaust played, under the surface, in the ravine bottom, that under the surface. And this one has some odd features. It has parts of the surface have an odd green coloration that is, I'm very familiar with the type of volcanic rock that this is. There's a lot of it around there. And it has a translucency to it. It's not anything that's natural to that type of magmatic material at all, and which I'm well aware of. But it also appears to have, it has quartz, it's magmatic material that slowly cooled underground long enough that some quartz crystals and other crystals grew within the mass of the volcanic material. And it appears that on the surface, these appear, at least visually and under the microscope, to look as though they melted. Now, if they melted, this is very important because the ground mass in which they grew, which is hard rock too, is not melted. And in order to explain that, it takes a fairly complex explanation, but to try to simplify it, noted that the landing exhaust, the more pointed this out to me, it impressed him immensely. He'd seen launches at White Sands, and he'd seen tests of rocket engines, and he was in the Army. And he expected this thing when he realized it wasn't blowing up. He expected this exhaust to be bouncing off, but he said it wasn't. It was just knifing straight into the ground. Well, people say, well, Ray, that must have not been a rocket engine. That was a plasma engine. Well, they're wrong. Plasma would not have done that either. You would have had very strong electrical effects that he would have felt, and you would have had some stuff flying up at him. Nothing flew up at him at all. And what this almost certainly was that it was an engine that was apparently accelerating subatomic particles to relativistic velocities, which gives them great mass and thus a propulsive effect. And if you were doing this, what you would do, you would drive these subatomic particles into the atoms of rocks and things beneath. And then they would, it can be shown that in most, this type of thing, depending on which particle was involved in the acceleration, you would get radioactivity temporarily, which it turns out that Ted Jordan's film that was taken within a few minutes after the thing had left was the Air Force wouldn't give it back because it was fogged by radiation. But the thing is, if you have this kind of propulsion, you have to have a magnetic field that's oscillating in a way that will drive those particles. And such an oscillating field would be required, hypothetically, to make these crystals melt while the ground mass didn't melt. In other words, when the crystals are the right length, the right type, they have the right response to the magnetic field, they begin to oscillate, and in oscillating at high speed, generate heat, which subsequently melts them. Now, I have to do some tests to make sure that this is what has happened. I'm not saying that that's what happened, but it looks like that's what happened. But I have another rock that I found a small rock that was right where the exhaust had played, on the surface of the ground. And it is even more promising because it has even, to me, and my wife, who is a good devil's advocate for anything I ever say, she agrees with me that absolutely it looks like quite a number of crystals are melted in this, and a different type of quartz crystals, and a different type of crystal is actually turned black and fractured due to apparently some type of resonant effects or heat, and yet the ground mass itself is not melted again. So it will be the same situation, but this more extreme because it was right almost in the center of where this takeoff engine had played. And people say, well, why didn't somebody pick this up? Well, it was small. Whereas what was picked up was a rock that was right to one side of it that the policeman described as looking bubbly and kind of burned it to where it had gotten kind of powdered-looking, maybe on the surface. That one was taken, and I have reason to believe it was taken by Captain Richard T. Holder over to White Sands because there's documents that indicate he said, we're equipped over there to take care of this. In other words, it never came into the hands directly of the Air Force. That came by Captain Holder, who was Army, over to White Sands, and the Army took at least the initial charge of it.
Now, J. Allen Hynek was on the site, and you had some conversations with him. Did you speak with him afterwards about this whole thing to get his true opinion of it?
Oh, I've talked to him many times about it. We became good friends. He knew me from back when he had when I had totally cooperated with him. In investigating the event where in 1959, July 28, a friend and I filmed simultaneously with 8 and 16 millimeter cameras the motherships of smaller objects. And he had been involved in that, and I'd cooperated fully in providing him the Air Force first generation copies of the film to study. And he appreciated this, and that's why he recognized me. I told Zamora to tell him about that when he had met with him the night before. After he came out, I said, when you see Allen Hynek, tell him that Ray Stanford is here, who corresponded with him about that film from Corpus Christi in 1959. Well, he did. And as a result, there was a closed site. Nobody was allowed at the landing site on the morning of Tuesday, the 29th of April, 1964. Just Zamora, the witness, and Sam Chavez, the New Mexico State Patrolman, who was the first to arrive after the radio call, and Hynek. But when I was, I had the dispatcher radio down there and ask if I could come down, and Chavez got on the phone, Sergeant Chavez, and said, no way, no, this is closed, this is for us, nobody's coming in here, you're not allowed that fellow in here. Well, Hynek, to his credit, got on the radio phone on the cop car, the state police car, and said, no, tell Ray Stanford to come on down here, I'd be happy to see him, tell him to come on down here. Wow. And so, much to his credit, we did. And he subsequently visited me in Phoenix, and had a wonderful visit there some months later, and in San Antonio, and then numerous times when I was in Austin, which is another interesting story in itself.
Well, so he was involved with Project Blue Book at the time, but afterwards when he kind of came over to the other side, basically,
yes.
Did you have conversations about this? And,
yes. And yes. Well, he said, you know, this was, I don't know if he used these exact words, but he said it was basically the straw that broke the camel's back of his skepticism. He realized, he was very impressed, he said, with Lonnie Zamora. I mean, he was a perceptive, sensitive, intelligent man. And when you talk to Zamora and see his objectivity and his attempt in his answers to be accurate and precise and not allow, you know, what he said to be in any way misinterpreted, he was so impressive. I mean, I'll tell you the truth, I have never run into as good a witness as Lonnie Zamora, I don't think. I mean, he was wonderful and totally objective. Hynek appreciated this. And Hynek later, we had him sit down in front of our executive office in the building where our executive offices were in Austin, as contrast with our lab, which was out northwest of town. And had him sat down there, and he agreed. And I had a professional video camera come, and I have a video, high quality video recording of him confirming that the Air Force did not return Ted Jordan's film because it had been fogged and damaged as though by radiation and might give clues to an exotic type of propulsion. The Air Force could not allow the film and the evidence to get out because of that. I actually have him on tape saying that.
Wow, how about that? You know, I think Zamora is, you know, just from what I've seen and, you know, witnessed in interviews and stuff like that, he just seems like he was a very private person and wanted really nothing to do with this controversy, but just got involved in it and had to deal with it. Is that kind of accurate?
Yes, well, that is correct. But I believe that I've gotten some insight into part of his reticence to talk to his family about this. You see, he had promised, he's a man of his word, he had promised Ted Jordan that he would never describe the real symbol, that he would, in fact, substitute the fake symbol, which was the arch with the arrow in it and the line underneath it. And so, what do you tell your kids? What do you tell your wife, your immediate family, or your close relatives? Do you lie to them? So I think Lonnie was the type that he just said, well, I'd prefer not to talk about it. Because anybody, when he gets to the fact that he saw something red on the side of the object, a shape, they're going to say, well, what'd you see? You don't lie to your son, your daughter. Now, his daughter was only 4 at the time that this happened. But I'll tell you, when she turned 21, she asked him, she said, look, Dad, you never want to talk about this, but can you tell me now? And he said, look, you see that big box over there? I've got all these magazine articles and letters from all over the world. I've not answered any of them. But he said, nobody in all those articles got the story accurate, completely accurate. The only one person got the whole story and got it all accurate, and that was Ray Stanford. That's his book over there on the shelf. If you want the full story, the complete story, and the accurate story, read the book. And that's exactly what she did, and she wrote me. And so we exchanged correspondence several times and talked at length on the telephone when she was grown up. And she's a wonderful person. She wrote me a very sweet, kind letter appreciating the eulogy I'd written to Lonnie when he passed on in November. I guess it's been 3 years ago now.
Oh, I didn't realize it was that recent.
Well, it may have been 4 years. Yeah. As of this November, it may be 4 years.
Uh-huh. Excuse me. This is, to me, this is one of the strong cases, one of the big cases. When people ask me, you know, what I think is one of the really big cases out there, this is definitely one of them, and one of them that is not going to, in my opinion, not going to go away. But as far as a lot of these cases have witnesses come forward later when more and more of the story gets out, whether it's the video you mentioned, the documentary you mentioned earlier, do people come forward or have people come forward since this made, you know, television?
Not really, no. There are people that have contacted me that were lying and lied. Uh-huh. One woman said, oh, she was riding a horse there, just riding right up the edge of the bridge, and she saw the thing land, and she saw it take off, and she saw Zamora pull up there. Well, she's lying. You know how? I know. In the first place, there were no horses stationed around that particular part of Socorro, but had she been on that horse, she wouldn't be on it very long. When that thing took off, As long as Zamora hit the ground in a prone position, you can bet that horse would have thrown her off its back real fast.
Oh, yeah. You know, you don't really hear a lot of you don't hear a lot of cases where a UFO makes a loud roar, and this is just one of those.
Actually, no, you don't hear a lot of them. But let me point out that there, if you look at literature, in my book I give quite a list of similar objects, and there are cases where this has occurred, and Lonnie Zamora, I think, was a little closer to, he was actually, contrary to what most of the accounts say, we stood right there. I stood right beside the police car where Lonnie, it was the state police car, but he had had, Hynek asked the state policeman to drive it up under Lonnie's instruction there, right to exactly where he parked his car. So we stood there, and contrary to the poets who say that Lonnie Zamora didn't hit the ground until he was the other side of the car, that's pure baloney. He moved 15 feet from the car, and the exhaust, the takeoff exhaust, turned on, and he trained to defend himself in explosion, swept his head back around the other way toward the car, and hit the ground, face, you know, turned to one side, and belly down when it happened. Then when he realized it was sustained and was not an explosion, of course, he took off watching over his shoulder. That's why he ran into the back fender, the bumper, or the side of the fender of the car, because he was looking over to see what was happening. But anyway, he, at his closest point, Hynek had me walk it off. And I walked it off, and it was 35 feet, as best I could tell from the steps that I were taking. Hynek agreed. He was, when he hit the ground, he was 35 feet from the object, and that's frighteningly close.
Wow, I didn't realize that. Yeah, because the depictions you see, you know, in video, he's quite a distance away.
Yeah, that's right. They all got it wrong. Look at the drawing in my book that shows him there on the ground, and the car is over to the right, and you can see the back part of the car, and you can see where he is. That shows it very accurately. We put tremendous amount of time as far as the drawings, as for the accuracy of the landing gear and how it was oriented in the ravine and so on and so forth. In talking with Zamora and working with the I do the initial drawings, and I had them redrawn by a professional former aerospace draftsman, John Lucas, and we put tremendous effort to make every detail of those, including Zamora's position on the ground, very accurate.
Now, long after, say, okay, so that would happen back in 64, say 20 years later, was Lonnie still getting hassled about this?
Well, he after the police thing, it got to where, you know, kids would say, "Oh, see any little green men lighting this guy?" Said, "Well, he decided to leave the police force, and you know, that makes him easy to spot in the first place, and mm-hmm. Police uniform, and hey, that's the officer that saw the thing." So he went to work for a service station there in Socorro, on the south side of town, and eventually he stepped to the job working in the place where they trash. Where they, I don't know what they did in relationship with this trash, moving it around or what they did, but he took that job. And he was always quite willing to keep a job and support his family. And very nice man who cared very much. He was a pillar of his community. He was deeply respected by all the people, not only in the town, but especially by those who knew him in church. He was a very religious man. And when Chavez drove up there and saw, he was white as a sheet, and he had cold sweat. He was so freaked out by this. And Chavez said, "Bonnie, you look like you've seen a ghost." And he said, "Maybe I have." And he said, later he said, "Maybe I should have gone and seen a priest."
Hmm. Did he ever try to explain it away as something prosaic himself?
Oh, not at all.
Yep.
Lonnie, in the first place, I mean, he was an intelligent man. And when the FBI agent, J. Arthur Burns, told him, "If I were you, I wouldn't talk about seeing those little figures beside the vehicle." This, he later told me, years later, he said, "You know, this was one of the things that originally made me wonder, wait a minute, what are they hiding?" And, you know, I'm sure Burns tried to make, "Well, you know, people make fun of you." But the government had a vested interest. If he would describe human-size people beside it, you know, everybody said, "Well, it's just a black project craft," but that's not what he saw. That's not what he described. It's ironic. We stood right there beside the creosote bush. I was standing right where one of the two little figures had been standing. And when we asked him about it, he put his hand up a place on the bush, and he said, I know right here where this limb was. I could see him over there on the right. He said, his head came right to here. And I said, well, so that's the height? He said, yeah. He said, about the size of a 10-year-old boy. And that's the one that the near one was the one that turned and looked, suddenly jerked and looked around toward the car. He said, looked like he was startled. Now, what is ironic about this, he stood there and described the figure. He said it looked like a little boy, about 10 years old, in white coveralls, the both of them did. And so then we drove into the media conference at the motel in Socorro, and he said to Walter, in response to Walter Schoed's questions, well, read it in the book. As I describe it as pussyfooting. I mean, he never said anything to me about seeing any people. He described, well, as if there were some white coveralls, you know. I think he actually, I forget, you have to read the word in the book. But, I mean, you think, what were they hanging on a clothesline beside the obvious white coveralls and nobody was in them? And, you know, he absolutely, I mean, we had just had this conversation with Zamora no more than 20 minutes ago. And he's telling this outright lie because the Air Force didn't want him to acknowledge that there were any little people,
right,
people, whatever they were.
Yeah. So, Ray, we have just under a half hour left, or actually like 20 minutes left to the show. And I wondered if you wanted to move on to another topic.
Yep, sure.
All right.
You name it.
Yeah. So we were back. We were talking earlier about you wanted to talk about anomalous excursion phenomena.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Now the anomalous excursion is really something that also took us totally by surprise. I never anticipated this until I started filming these things in broad daylight and begin to study the films. You will see things, and an object you may see things so fast you don't know what you've seen until you look at the film. But here's let me give you an example. Now there was the fabulous event of 12/12/77, which my wife and I were flying down. I've been on the old TV show To Tell the Truth with Joe Garagioli's host, and we're flying back from LaGuardia to DFW, and we had an incredible encounter with smaller objects and a gigantic mothership, for lack of better terminology, and got amazing film. And that's the one where the pilot came down, brought his wife down to see it, and confessed that he saw it. Okay, but that was on the 12th of December, 1977. But on the 20th of December, I'd been up with my wife in Toronto, for three TV appearances there, and we're flying back at cruise altitude, and I filmed an object that I don't know why I haven't looked. Usually when I watch for UFOs on the airline, when I look straight out or between straight out and the ground, but for some reason I just had a gut feeling to get down in my seat and croak my head, get my neck back up, and look up high up above the airliner. And here comes this bright triangular object coming down from high above, where the sky is really blue up there. And I filmed it all the way down through the ground. When it gets near the ground, you actually can see it has a corona. And as it gets near the ground is about half covered with snow. You can see its shadow closing with its own shadow on the ground. And you can see the reflection shadow of the corona on the ground along with the shadow of the object per se. It's incredible. But anyway, as this object is coming down, at times I could see what I call the doppelganger, or the ghost of the object. Often I have filmed in these cases. Beneath it, it looks like, instead of the bright triangle, a dark triangle beneath it. And these things are coming down together, apparently, change their position relationship to one another, change somewhat. But the amazing thing is, and I followed them all the way down with the film, but when I got the film and analyzed it, in one frame, here, and understand this is not camera motion, because you got the object clearly there, nothing smeared, it's broad daylight, but these two objects, you see a streak go from these objects, the ghost and what I call the target object, you see them streak way over to the right, far over, way over, and then make a sharp turn and come back down and then shoot back up to their original position. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, a little distance, I'm talking about, you know, 100, 150 diameters they have moved, of the object, so they have moved away from it and back up. And this is in, mind you, the time of a single frame exposure.
Oh.
And it's not described on the film. It is an optical image. And we see this, I have this kind of thing in numerous examples of it. This is just perhaps one of the most dramatic ones that I remember because I worked with it and put it in one of my PowerPoint presentations. But even the first movie film I got, September 18, 1956, 12:55 in the noon hour, on the high desert of California, we have the same thing. I mean, of course, we didn't know that. We didn't have the equipment to enlarge these and look at them years ago, but we did years later. And but even back then, the very first film, you have this phenomenon. And this shows how little we know about what these objects are doing. You know, I say to people, Martin, that, you know, everybody wants to think in terms of 1950s movies. Oh, this is alien experiment coming to Earth. They're studying the Earth. They're just discovering us. Oh, baloney. Listen, I've seen the same, I've filmed the same classes of objects again and again from the 1950s on, and the reports show them way back in time as well. Triangular objects. There are triangular objects that are black project craft, but the things that we have seen in film and that were described in the 18th and 19th centuries were not the black project craft. But anyway, that is the anomalous excursion was one of the things that surprised all of us that were studying these films. And I say us, I mean, I had a whole paid staff working with me in my corporation down in Texas, including a high-level PhD physicist who had his PhD in astronomy from the best astronomy school in the world, the University of Arizona at Tucson. And we realize that, well, I tell people, you know, if you think you know what these things are, you're wrong. No matter what you think, you're wrong. Because I think that at least the more advanced of these things that we have seen and filmed are, I don't think we can comprehend them. And I think it's sad that people want to project their own little fantasies and their psychic fantasies into these things. It's better that we study the objects as phenomena, quit trying to dream our dreams into them, and begin to try, as scientists do when they're studying the universe, to let it tell us its story rather than project our concepts into it.
You know, that is a very good statement, and I agree 100% with what you're saying. And I say that in different ways. And one of the things that the scientists do, I believe, that they kind of put their dream into it is dark matter. You know, I mean, they see a problem and they try to fix it with this theory of dark matter until that is, you know, scientifically proven to exist. I don't think that they should, you know, count on it so strongly as they do.
Yeah, some of them, I think, have gone maybe a little overboard. Well, you know, this is the way. Fortunately, science is a self-correcting mechanism, and unlike religion, it has the mechanism by which eventually, even though they may err off in some interpretation of certain data, at least eventually it gets corrected, whereas in religion, it seems like the errors get magnified and brought to the forefront more than any correction mechanism. There are some religions for example, the Roman Catholic Church did some terrible things back long ago, as we know, but their whole philosophy and spirit and approach to things has changed. So I don't want to make a blanket condemnation of religion, but I do say at least science has peer review, and over a period of time, eventually a clear image of what we're actually looking at comes to pass. And the reason I've been working the area I work in is because I feel my data. Let me break in a moment with this and say, in 1978, I was contacted by telephone by a man I never heard of in my life. He was at the American Association of Advancement of Science annual meeting in Houston, Texas that year, and he said, "Mr. Stanford," he said, "I have been told by a colleague of mine here at the AAAS conference that you feel you filmed a gigantic pulse plasma engine operating in the stratosphere on the 12th of December, 1977. Is that correct?" And I said, "Yes, sir, that is my interpretation of what I saw and filmed." And he said, "Okay, I am the dean of the School of Applied Science and Engineering at Princeton University." What he didn't tell me is he was also head of the Plasma Research Center there. And he said, "Would you be willing to show this film to me?" I said, "Yes, sir, I would be delighted to show it to you." He said, "Well, I thought you would from what my colleague told me." His colleague had seen it. And he said, "Could you meet me at the airport?" And I said, "Sure." So I picked him up, and my twin brother, his wife, and his lab assistant, and my wife and I sat there, and we projected this film back and forth for him, and he was thrilled. And he said, "Congratulations." He said, "You know, I didn't tell you before I came, that my major area of research is pulse plasma engines for deep space applications. And there are only three of us experts on this in the world. Two are in Russia, and I just got back from visiting them. And I myself, well, now, of course, there are a lot of people in pulse plasma, but then, in 1978, he said, "Did you hear the news tonight?" I said, "What news, sir?" He said, "Well, about the pictures that were taken out at Jupiter with the spacecraft." And I said, "Yes, it's thrilling." He said, "Well, that was my Mercury ion engine that maneuvered that craft." He said, "But, you know, I didn't tell you this before I came, because if this was a fake film that you had faked in claiming it's a pulse plasma engine, knowing that I was an expert in pulse plasma, you would never have invited me." But he said, "I thought if this was a hoax, then, you know, I could catch you." He said, "But congratulations. After examining this, I can tell you, you have filmed the most immense conceivable pulse plasma engine operating in the stratosphere." He said, "My only question is it like my little engine out there carrying its own fuel along to electrify and eject magnetically, or is it electrifying the atmosphere?" Well, I knew it was electrifying the atmosphere, but I said, "Well, sir, I prefer you answer that. I'm not going to try to answer for you." And he said, "I want to say one more thing." He said, "You know, the people that feel they're into UFOs, most of them don't take the approach you seem to be taking. They seem to be interested in the gee whiz aspect of this." And he said, "You know, they may never understand this film. But," he said, "let me tell you, you can show this to any scientist that's involved in plasma research, and they will back you 100%. He said, "Where that beam is generated, where it comes off the end of the object, its electron temperature is evidenced in its color, the way it changes." He said, "They will all know immediately that this is real. So never fear the scientists. It's the pseudoscientists that may get after you."
Oh, wow.
And that was wonderful. And, you know, now that he had told me, you know, where he was. And I found this to be the case. The people that love this, are the more knowledgeable they are, the more they love the evidence I have to show them, because they understand the physics and they understand the engineering. Whereas a layperson, they don't know. You might as well be talking Greek to them.
Now, just a thought here. Have you ever considered, I don't even know if this would be possible, but to get a gathering from Goddard Space Center, since you're so connected there?
Oh, I assure you that in fact we're planning on it. As I mentioned earlier, I mean, I was honored to speak in this famous science colloquium lecture series, and where some of the most famous science in the world is spoken. But they know me, and I could tell a lot of stories about my good relationship with people there. We're going to propose very soon that I do a presentation there at the science colloquium lecture series, and believe me, they will love it, and they will see the beam ahead. They will see the multi-imaging. They will see the anomalous excursions. And they will, these kind of things will communicate to them that this is a reality. And, you know, we can lighten the topic by saying this is what the Goddard Dinosaur Tracker sees, attracts when he's looking up instead of when he's looking down. But they will love it. And as the dean of the School of Applied Science and Engineering told me, I have great confidence. They will love it because everyone that I have showed there, and I can't, you know, name who and tell who all I've showed this to there, because that's their private interest. But I know that their response will be not only positive, it will be enthusiastic, absolutely enthusiastic, even as Professor Mirabeau, when he was here, as his was, because if they have enough background, they will know. And scientists have a way of knowing when you're talking their language. And if you use it properly, in the proper context, interpreting what you're saying, they will understand. So that I'm looking forward to that. I'm glad you mentioned it, because that is going to happen.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, Ray, I consider you a guardian of all this important, shall I say, evidence of what you have. And, you know, I was really disappointed that it didn't work out, that I couldn't make it down there this weekend. I still plan, of course, on coming down. But who would be the next guardian of your material?
Well, that frightens me.
Hmm.
Because to tell you the truth, I don't know. That is a real problem, because it has to be somebody who thinks analytically and who appreciates this from the physics standpoint, as I do, even though I'm not a professional physicist, and somebody that is motivated to exposit this scientifically and publish it. in various appropriate peer-reviewed, hopefully, formats. And, you know, I really don't know. I am at a great loss. I mean, I'm 76 years old. I have three stents in my coronary arteries. And, you know, I could drop dead tonight. And it frightens me. There are times when I've said to my wife, I said, if I die suddenly, I want this burned. I don't know anybody to give it to that would be safe. But on the other hand, I hope that a solution can be found, and I'm looking for a solution. And I would prefer that it were not an individual, but a group. I mean, when I worked best and most efficiently was when we had our well-financed group back in Austin. And I would prefer that it be a group that has that where there's a group of people with a that basic scientific consensus of how to work with these kinds of. See, these are evidences that are diagnostic. I mean, they can tell us incredible things about this. I need, as I've told people at Goddard, I need Nobel laureate level minds to work with this. The multiple imaging, for example, and a number of other things. I mean, it's just there's so much here that I'm hoping for a miracle. I don't know how it's going to happen, but I just hope that by talking about this, we might draw the right people in.
Now, is there anything that you can actually publish yourself that's important?
Oh, sure. Yes, there is. There's a lot. The thing is, you know, now, of course, I don't have a PhD. To get into these major scientific publications, I need PhDs working with me, which I can do. But that scientific papers, I know from my dinosaur papers, oh, man, they're so long to write, and you often have to rework them and rework them to get them acceptable to the, you know, to the review committee and so on. And I would like to find a super good agent that would do a book that is scientifically oriented, but that communicates with the intelligent, interested public. My audience is people that are not people that believe the world is 4,000 years old. I'm talking about people that have a background, even though they may not be professional scientists, and intelligent, analytical people. And there are millions of those people out there who will appreciate this if it's published in the right form. But I want to find an agent that is powerful enough that he can get it published by a major publisher. There's two books, and I'm not going to call a name that I don't think a whole lot of. They've been published in the field by a major agent, and they got reviewed in New York Times, for example, because of who published them. You've got to have that kind of level of publishing, or they don't get reviewed in these places, and therefore do not get the worldwide coverage and interest that you need. And that's what if I'm going to go in a public format with this rather than just a strictly scientific format, it has to be in that kind of a format. I'm not going to give it to some small-time publisher that, you know, is not going to get reviewed in the New York Times, for example. I've got to have that. I hope somebody's listening that has that clout or knows a good agent.
I do, too. And, you know, for some of the things, you may want to consider what Dave Marler, last week's guest, who is on, is starting that nonprofit organization to preserve, right, you know, documents and things like that. So,
by the way, I'm sharing some things with David now that I'm giving the opportunity, if he wants to from the July 20, 1959 film. I was sending already some pictures, going to send him some that are better that show the triangular objects in relationship to the mothership and near the mothership and right at it in some cases, and offering him to use them. But the one thing he said that I want to discuss with him that bothers me, and I think once he sees more of this material, he'll change his mind. I agreed with everything he said. I've never heard anybody I agree with so much. I really like him. In my opinion, as far as those that are out publicly, he is the best in the field as far as his attitude. And he's not anybody's fool. He's not naive. He calls a spade a spade. And I really love him. He's impressive. But
very
the one
impressive
thing he said that bothered me, he said, a good multi-witness case with radar, I consider far more valuable than any photograph or video. Wrong, wrong, wrong. No, if it is a well-documented video or even photograph that has high resolution, from the standpoint of what science can do with it, there's no doubt. I mean, radar, all it tells you is the speed and the distance. And my gosh, There are data in these films that self-provide that. Let me give you an example of what you're doing right up. 12-77, it would pulse these big plasma beams, but to do that, they would generate a ball of plasma at whichever end of the mothership it was going to pulse off of, and you, at that moment, it collapses into the beam. You actually see the Faraday rings because of the strong magnetic pulse that generated it. But what you also see is the collapse, like when you hear thunder, that's because the lightning has burned a column in the air, and when it collapses, it closes in on itself and makes a boom. Well, with the mothership, these motherships of that type were here in great numbers in the late 77 and in 78. And we heard the Great Eastern Booms, they were called. They were not made from jet planes. We have this on film in which you see the plasma ball collapse into the column, and you see the shot spheres expand at the speed of sound. Well, we know from various data the altitude this was, about 100,000 feet. We can calculate the speed of sound and use it as an exact ruler. We can calculate, thus, not only the size and the distance, we can account for and describe the energy that was involved. This is far better than radar would do for you. So a good film case, but it gives physics. People describing things do not give you physics, and just distance and size are not enough to do any great physics with except speed, and that's kid stuff. That's the kind of stuff you get out of people looking for in the 1950s. We are in a different age. We're in a computer age, and we can take data and crunch figures with a computer, and we can come up with some mighty interesting understanding of this material.
Right, right. So, Ray, you know, we only have about a minute left or so. And is there anything, and just keep that in mind, is there anything you want to wrap this up with?
Oh, I just want to say that when I do get the breakthrough that I need, I not only want to publish books about this hard evidence we've been talking about, these Ferris films, but I want to do a new book on Socorro. And it will show some wonderful things, including a wonderful photograph in which I wish Lonnie Zamora were alive to see it, in which people will be able to see in broad daylight a photograph of the Socorro object with its landing gear deployed and quite a number of other things, too. But I want that, and I'm prepared, if I can find the right publisher, that, and we'd have about the evidence of radiation, Hynek's confirming that, and a whole lot of other things in it that have not been told publicly I would like to publish.
Okay, and so one more time, if you want to get Ray's book, you just go to PayPal and send dinosaurtracker@comcast.net. Did I get that right?
No, at Verizon.net.
I knew I'd screw that up. Okay.
Dinosaurtracker@Verizon.net.
Yeah, and $60, and make sure you give him your address plus a note that you want him to sign it.
And to who I should sign it, to whom I should sign it.
Yeah, that makes a difference. Hey, Ray,
thank you.
It's been absolutely wonderful. You're always a pleasure to talk to. And we have to wrap it up right now. So that's it. I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Alejandro Rojas for the news and our guest, of course. I want to thank Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for the music, Bruce Rainier for that new tune he sent us, Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. And remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. Well, next week's kind of exciting. We have space shuttle astronaut Story Musgrave. He's going to be on. And on May 6th, coming up, I'm going to do a live show at a Portland, Maine office that I have over there. And I'm going to invite some Maine UFO people. I've got a few that are committing to be there. But if you live in Maine and you want to make the trip down to Portland, please join us on May 6th. You can check us out live next week right here in the Dark Matter Radio Network or every Wednesday at 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This is Martin Willis saying keep your eyes to the sky, and we'll see you next week.